From the Sky News Centre at 6. An investigation into allegations against British troops will be shut down within months. The Iraq Historic Allegations team is to close in the summer after MPs described it as an unmitigated failure. A parliamentary report says most of the abuse claims are not credible. The Army's Chief of Staff, General Sir Nick Carter, says it's a huge relief.
Where you get unscrupulous lawyers making vexatious allegations, it is absolutely inappropriate. I think this is something that will be really important. It'll make a big statement to the Army, and most importantly of all, I think, it shows that the government is four square behind supporting the Army.
A 27-year-old woman from Blackburn who's joined the fight against Islamic State in Syria says her decision was not just about going to war. Kimberly Taylor says she joined a female unit within the Kurdish forces because of the positive influence it has on young women. Fire investigators are examining the cause of a house fire in Manchester in which two people died. Four children and a man were also injured in the blaze in Withington this morning. A stash of cocaine has been discovered washed up on two beaches in Norfolk. The drug was packed into several holdalls. It's claimed one in five rail passengers using a ticket machine could be buying the wrong fare. Kieran Core reports.
These passengers find the technology confusing.
Frustrating.
Quite a pain.
Complicated.
And the rail regulator agrees. Its studies found 13% of commuters are overpaying, while 7% buy the wrong ticket and risk a fine. The Office of Rail and Road wants change.
Train companies could offer a price guarantee. Then you could ask the train company to refund the difference.
But the group representing train operators says regulations make it difficult to offer simpler fare options. The government's already announcing reforms to ticketing.
And some British Airways cabin crew are going on strike again in a row over pay. Members of the Unite Union will walk out for 4 days from next Friday. That's the latest. I'm Victoria Lawrence.
You see, folks, all science is merely a means to an end. The means is knowledge. The end is control. And most of you don't understand it and never have understood it, and many of you never will understand that. And those in power believe that the end always justifies the means.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Half a million children under threat of starvation in Yemen as we speak. Saudi Arabia's bombing using British bombs and British jets, while the Royal Navy, US Navy and Saudi navies are blockading the country. Why? Well, British arms firms made £3.3 billion selling weapons to Saudi Arabia. That's just last year. Perhaps that's got something to do with it. And our servicemen and women aren't in danger because they're mostly killing unarmed civilians. The majority of the 10,000 people in the UN said last month to have now been killed in Middle East's poorest country and the cradle of Arab civilization. President Trump, the village of Yirrkala in Yemen, presented the opportunity for him on Sunday the 29th of January to sign off his first special operations raid. His Navy SEALs killed 23 civilians, including an 80-year-old man, as well as an 8-year-old girl and a newborn baby. The secret video they say they seized in the raid wasn't. It was available all the time online. And continuing on from last week, we'll be looking at the acronym Protecting Yourself in a Cyber War. And I'm joined in the studio by Dr. Judith Brown. Hi, Judith. Welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi, Tony.
Now, tell us a bit about your experience in Yemen in the past.
Well, I worked there between 1998 and 2001. I worked on a refugee health programme and made many friends there. And it was a wonderful place. And I've been going back there every year until 2014, until the start of the war.
Just give us a bit of, I mean, we heard just last month 10,000 dead now in this. I mean, we could call it a war, some people call it a slaughter, because the amount of technology coming from the air, the bombs raining down on people, really there is no way for them to fight back against Saudi Arabia.
Absolutely. The majority of people who are being killed are civilians, and actually the death toll, it's just a guess. They really don't know. I mean, I personally know people who've died, and people that I know, sometimes they tell me that huge members of their family have been killed, 27 or something like this. So from the small number of people that I know in Yemen, it would be extremely unlikely that I would know people that had died in the war. Obviously, they only count conflict deaths if the bodies are presented at hospital. Over half of the hospitals are closed now, partly because they're bombed, partly because there's no staff or no supplies. And so, therefore, you can say that the ones that are closed are the ones in the areas that are more likely to be affected by bombing. So I think that the death toll is a serious underestimate. And UNICEF as well says that one child is dying every 10 minutes from non-violent things, diseases that were easily treatable in Yemen before the war, and now they're not being able to be treated because there's no medical care available. Things like, for example, diarrhea, respiratory infections. So the death toll is significantly more than 10,000, Tony.
Now, I know you've managed to procure somebody on the phone line for us. Can you tell us who they are, where they're calling from?
Fouad, he's a journalist, and at the moment he's doing a course in Jordan, and so that's why we're able to talk to him. As you know, we've tried to ring people up in Yemen this evening, but the lines are all down and we can't talk to anyone.
We've also tried Skype too. Apparently Skype is quite often not working.
Yeah, and it's down at the moment. So Fouad is, fortunately for us, is actually in Amman at the moment. He's a journalist in Yemen. He's very familiar with the things that are going on militarily, the politics of Yemen. He's personally knows a lot about the Trump fiasco. So he's willing to talk to you about that.
Okay, Fouad, can you hear me?
Yeah, I hear you.
Okay, Fouad, can you just tell us a bit about your background in journalism in Yemen?
Yeah, I think you mean about my journalism in Yemen, or the situation of journalism in Yemen. What do you mean?
I mean your background before the war.
Oh, okay, before the war. Before the war, the situation was different. The war has changed every aspect of the life in Yemen. This is the summary of the situation after the war. Before the war, the situation was, I can say, stable. The poverty rate was not very huge. And you can say everything, I think, was... Yeah, there was, you can say, poverty, there was little insecurity. But after the war, everything has changed very, 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 very much, beyond expectation.
Okay, and can you give us your thoughts on the causes of the Saudi attacks on Yemen?
The latest attack, Saudi attacks on Yemen.
Yeah, what's the cause?
Yeah, I think, you are asking about the Saudi attacks on Yemen.
Yeah, why did the war break out in the first place?
Yeah, because Saudi Arabia is fighting its own war, and it's fighting a proxy war in Yemen. Proxy war, I mean, for the West, mainly or especially the US and the UK. And its own war, you mean that it was a great or a big ally of the former president and regime. And the former president and regime then allied with Iran and its proxies in Yemen, the Houthi militia. So Saudi launched its war in Yemen for two reasons. Its own war against the former president of Iran, and a proxy war for the US and the UK in particular.
What about the situation now? Because we've got this new President Trump, and he, it looks like, has chosen Yemen for his first special operation, which didn't go very well. In fact, it ended up apparently, and maybe you can verify some of this, apparently ending up with an 80-year-old man being killed, also an 8-year-old girl and a newborn baby, as well as 23 civilians being killed. Doesn't sound like much of a special operation by the American military to be killing all these civilians and children and old people.
Well, let me tell you about the U.S. intentions in Yemen at the moment. You know that according to my information, I think 25 civilians were killed, including a baby. That was, you could say, that a bullet struck his mom's stomach. This is one. And I think the U.S. plans, you can say, they just continuing its support to Saudi Arabia, and it's continuing its war with Iran in Yemen. So I think Donald Trump is, you can say, is not that skilled with politics and, you can say, foreign policies. Many people say that and see that Donald Trump is rushing toward Yemen, and that this is a problem because the U.S. hints, and I think the U.S. has sent military, okay, say warships to Yemen, and including a destroyer, and it hinted at several times that it plans further military interventions in Yemen. And the U.S. policy or strategy in Yemen, in particular in the Middle East in general, I think it's to go to further military or direct interventions, and this is a problem.
Well, what about, if I can just interrupt you, can you just give us an idea of what life is like on the ground in Yemen now?
Ordinary people living look like at the moment in Yemen.
That's right, yeah. I mean, what's sort of living conditions like? I mean, ease of access to housing, food, water, this sort of thing.
Yeah, the situation is very catastrophic. The summary of the humanitarian or the living situation in Yemen is like this. Some families in some regions, you can say, let me put you in the right situation in Yemen. You can divide the Yemen into two regions. Some regions under the control of the government, and some regions under the control of the Houthi militia and the former president Alaa Abdel Saleh. So in southern regions, which are under control of the government, the situation is not very bad. But in the western, southwestern, eastern, middle, and north, and far north, the situation is very bad. Some families in Sana'a, for example, some families in Sana'a live on one meal a day, and many can't find a meal in days. And if we review UN statistics or figures about Yemen, the situation is horrible. You can say that 2/3 of the population need basic aid. They are struggling for wood, for food, water. There is no electricity. So, in general, the UN says that 3 million, including more than 2 million children, are acutely malnourished. It's about the war and the blockade. The blockade, which was imposed by the Saudi-led coalition 2 years ago, has deepened the situation very much. You know that Yemen imports 90% of its food imports. Now, the blockade has restricted everything. People are struggling. People are dying from hunger. This is the summary. People in Yemen are dying from hunger and preventable diseases because of the blockade and the continuing battle. Some aid agencies can't reach most affected areas, and this is a big problem. There are, I can say, people in most affected areas that people want to help them, but they can't reach them because of the ongoing ground battles and ongoing airstrikes.
Anyway, UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund, is saying there's a 500,000 children in Yemen facing life-threatening malnutrition. So why don't the Houthis and President Saleh, just give up? Because surely that if the people are starving, the children are starving, then their war is not worth fighting.
The Houthi and Saleh forces are not fighting for the population or for the people. They are fighting for their own interests. And you know that? They know that people are starving. People are dying from hunger. People are dying in hospitals because there are no medicines, no medical staff, no everything. So the situation is very complicated. We can't give an accurate description of the situation. Houthi and Saleh Alliance is not fighting for the people. People are dying, but they can't do anything. And they can't stop fighting. And Saudi Arabia, which she says she is helping, it is helping that many people, she, you can say, is wrong as well. Because it's not a good idea, it's not correct to say that we are helping people with killing them and starving them or besieging them.
So what would you like to see happen now in Yemen to bring a quick end to this?
I don't think, there is no hope for peace in Yemen. This is the ugly truth. There is no hope for peace in Yemen. You know that the situation is very complicated. I said before earlier, I think that Saudi Arabia is fighting two wars. It's all war and the proxy war. And it's, I think that regional and international players should be serious about peace. And peace, I mean, they should change their minds about the situation in Yemen. They say in public and via media that they want peace, but on the ground they are continuing the war. Then they are determined about a military victory. This is the truth, the ugly truth that no one wants to speak about. I think the international community should be serious about peace. This is the first thing. And the other thing, I think the UN should find effective mechanisms to enforce or convince local factions to commit themselves to international resolutions or to peace deals, to peace talks. The UN has sponsored peace talks several times. All rounds of talks have failed, and this is a big problem. And I think the problem is not restricted to the local factions. The regional and international leaders which are directly involved in the war in Yemen. So it's about the solution begins from abroad, not from inside Yemen. Because you know that our government is a puppet. It can't make any decision independently. Saudi Arabia is making all decisions about Yemen at the moment. And the U.S. and U.K. support to Saudi Arabia is, you can say, adding fuels to the fire.
Okay, Fouad Rajeh, thanks very much for joining us from Amman. And good luck on your investigations as you return to Yemen. Thanks very much for joining us on The Politics Show.
Okay, you are welcome anytime.
So that was Fouad Rajeh. Dr. Judith Brown, what do you make of what he's saying there? He's saying effectively that the government areas are the only areas which are really livable in Yemen, yeah. And yet the government is a puppet government.
Well, the government areas, I don't know that you would say that the government is actually controlling all of those areas. They're controlled by tribal entities that are really against the Houthi more than pro the government. And they are more stable because obviously they're not being bombed on a daily basis. And also they're getting food in from the ports on the south coast, from Aden and Makalla. And also some from Saudi Arabia too. So therefore because they've got food, the situation still isn't brilliant there. I've spoken to people from Aden recently, which actually has even worse communications than Sana'a. But they are saying that they only have very limited electricity, whereas they don't have any in Sana'a at all, but they've been so-called liberated now for 18 months, and yet they still haven't managed to get the electricity supplies working. There's still no running water in most of the areas in Aden, which was in every house before the war. And of course, they're still subject to these sporadic attacks from from extremist right Sunni militias, which can happen at any point. And so, although it isn't stable, it's a much better situation, and especially in Hadramaut, the area to the east. That a lot of that is under the control of some tribal people, and also some areas are still under the control of Al-Qaeda, but they are stable. And in fact, when you talk about Al-Qaeda in Yemen, it's there's this morphing really between the tribes and Al-Qaeda. People who fight for Al-Qaeda on one battle might be fighting for their tribes in the next. So there is some morphing, and the dividing lines are very unclear. But there is definitely Al-Qaeda sympathies in Hadramaut in some areas. But yes, definitely they're much more stable, the area that Saudi Arabia is attacking. And bear in mind, they're not just attacking buildings, they're attacking roads and they're attacking bridges. Now, a lot of the area in the what used to be north Yemen, which is actually on the west side of Yemen, is very mountainous, up to 8,000 feet. And so the towns were connected by roads and bridges. As soon as you start bombing those bridges, the means of getting any sort of goods in is very problematical. The embargo, which was led by Saudi Arabia, now UN has taken over the management of the embargo, but it still can't get food in because Saudi Arabia has bombed the cranes in Hodeidah, and they've got cranes to replace the cranes that are already there. But according to UN spokesman yesterday, Saudi Arabia have said that they're not going to allow them to fit them, and they're still bombing Hodeidah anyway. Andrew Mitchell went to Yemen last month, and he actually said that whilst he was there, Hodeidah port was bombed again. So even if they did put up new cranes, there's no guarantee that Saudi won't bomb them again.
Now, what I said at the top of the hour was this massive profit that British arms firms are making, and the very little coverage that we're getting. In fact, in a way, this war can only thrive through censorship of actually seeing what's happening. I mean, we had this massive night after night before Christmas about what was going on in Aleppo in Syria. Yeah. And yet this carnage going on in Yemen is hardly ever reported.
Exactly.
We've had also very important news out this week from a court case in London, which was brought by the Campaign Against the Arms Trade. Just looking at one of the articles about that on the Middle East Eye, which is a very, very good, I think, very good. I've met some of the journalists that work on there too.
Yes, yeah.
A very good source on Middle Eastern affairs, although it's very rarely picked up by Channel 4 News, by ITN, or by the BBC for broadcast, etc. And this amazing court case this week has revealed an incredible litany. In fact, a load of documents explaining just what the British are up to in there and what they're getting, what we're giving to the Saudis in exchange for the £3.3 billion that we're making out of selling arms to Saudi Arabia, who are doing the bombing, mostly from the air. Of course, it's not a war, it's a slaughter. Documents presented at the court case this week also revealed the full extent of Britain's military relationship with Saudi Arabia. We've got more than 100 civil servants and armed forces personnel, all paid with our taxpayers' money, folks. Indeed. Based in Saudi Arabia to, in inverted commas, ensure the supply of modern military aircraft, naval weapons and training. Now, that's what they're there officially to do. So 100 British civil servants there. Then also, British personnel and officials are based in the Saudi-led coalition's operational headquarters, where the conflict in Yemen is overseen and airstrikes are planned. The defence attaché at the British Embassy in Riyadh, the Saudi capital, regularly visits the coalition's operational headquarters. The officer who currently holds this role is a one-star general rank. I didn't know we had one-star generals in the British.
No, I didn't know, but apparently the only more senior chap is in Washington, and he's the most senior.
That's right. But, I mean, I thought this was a US thing. They have one-star generals, two-star generals, and whatever.
Yes, I'm not up on the military.
The Brits have just borrowed that, yeah. You know, from the Americans, like they do with everything else. The only British defence attaché, as you said, more senior in ranks, based in Washington. Also, the British Royal Air Force has a permanent liaison officer, or group captain rank, based in Riyadh. The UK military personnel are providing logistical and technical support and training to the Royal Saudi Armed Forces. The UK, I mean, this is what Fuad was saying when he talked about a proxy war. My God, you know, hundreds of Brits.
Yes,
helping
I thought
them,
that was quite interesting. He said this is a proxy war with Saudi Arabia fighting on behalf of USA and UK, which actually is how I see it too.
Just let me finish the list here. UK liaison officers are also based at the Saudi Arabian Ministry of Defence, the Royal Saudi Air Force headquarters. Also, UK officers have knowledge of targeting guidance. Now, quite what that means, knowledge of targeting guidance. Well, that means that they've got all the satellite pictures, doesn't it, from the Americans and maybe our own satellites too. And they're saying, well, drop your bombs here. And they're giving those to the Saudi forces operating in Yemen. So, I mean, British taxpayers' money is making sure that that this war continues, this slaughter continues, Judith.
Absolutely. And, the other thing is that's quite incredible. For example, there's a school in Hajar which has been bombed. They've actually found fragments of British bombs in the ground of that school. And now the British taxpayer, through our aid programme, is actually funding for tents so that the children can continue their schooling. But before the British bombs bombed it, they had a perfectly good brick-built school. Other things, like, for example, where we've scattered our cluster bombs in the fields, which means that the agriculture can't happen, of
which,
course.
Which, by the way, are illegal under international law.
Yeah, absolutely illegal. And, of course, we've now got there's a team in Yemen that are removing the cluster bombs, and would you believe it, but there's an ex-SAS officer paid through the British taxpayer to actually go around and collect in these cluster bombs which have been dropped. Now, to me, this is absolutely ridiculous. I mean, we're actually saying that we're going to put all this aid into Yemen, and yet we're allowing the port of Hodeidah to be bombed over and over again without any repercussions to the Saudis when they're actually bombing it. So the whole thing, it's sort of like, it's so topsy-turvy. It's sort of like giving here to compensate for, in a small way, for the damage that we're doing. But people, you know, for example, the people that we're trying to get in touch with tonight, but we haven't been able to in Yemen, I mean, both of those families were really middle-class families in Sana'a, and both of them owned land or owned property. In order to survive, they've had to sell the land and the property, so the, for example, properties that they were renting out and getting a rent income in, or land that was being farmed. Now they can no longer farm it, they can no longer get the rent in from the properties, because they've had to sell it in order to survive. But when they've spent that money, where are they going to go next? And you're talking about people who are really on the upper echelons of ordinary Yemeni society. A lot of the people who were previously poor, who hadn't got any property or hadn't got any savings. I mean, they're living on things like bread and water. One of the things that's really destabilised the situation is Hadi's moving of the Central Bank of Yemen, which everybody in the world was thinking that the chap who ran the Yemen Bank was absolutely performing miracles. He was paying people on both sides. He was completely impartial. So the civil servants were being paid in the north and the south. And Hadi, for some reason, I think that because there's more people in the north than there are in the south, obviously more money was going to the north, and that people were using the teachers, the nurses, the doctors were using that money to buy food. And so one of the things they moved the bank to Aden, it hasn't got there yet, it's not up and running, so therefore no salaries have been paid for 6 months. So people who used to have a salary, that salary is now gone. Of course, the people in the south, Hadi was never popular in the south, he was never popular anywhere in Yemen before the war, but the people in the south suddenly has got people who are interested in him, because as he's moved the bank to San, and he's also got they say he's got a government there. In fact, it isn't there. Most of the time, it's in Riyadh. But people are seeing it, that he's actually treading the path of the separatist path. So therefore, they see it more likely that they're going to have a separate state in the south because of the things that Hadi's done. So within a group of people in the south, Hadi, at long last, has got a few friends. But it's what's incredible is that we're bombing this country to put back the so-called legitimate president, Hadi, who was voted in to power in February 2012. He was the only person, he was uncontested, he was the only person standing in the election. His term was till 2014. In 2014, February 2014, he hung on to power. He didn't recall Parliament. In fact, he hadn't recalled Parliament during the whole of his term, nor did he have a second referendum to ask whether he should continue. Of course, what happened then was that other political leaders like Saleh, the ex-president, became obviously saw their chance because Hadi's term had actually expired, and that was the cause of the political instability.
Okay, well, look, let's just go back to this week. Yeah. On Tuesday, lawyers for the Campaign Against the Arms Trade argued in court Sajid Javid, the then business secretary with decision-making responsibility for arms exports, in other words, signing off all these licences for jets and bombs to go to Saudi Arabia to kill these Yemeni people, and ignored the advice of his own arms control expert. So he's gone past them, apparently. They presented an email to the court from Edward Bell, who's the policy head of the Export Control Organisation, and it detailed how Bell had told Javid that his gut tells me we should suspend these licences. The court also heard that officials within the Ministry of Defence removed a column in the tracking system dedicated to recording violations of international human rights law. Defending the government's position, Edie, the QC for the government, told the court that officials and ministers of the then Department for Business Innovation and Skills, which had decision-making power over these arms exports, made their decision after rationally examining the evidence and the so-called consolidated criteria. Gosh, I don't know what that on earth that's supposed to mean, for arms exports. So the long and short of this is that although the senior officials in the government, civil servants, are saying actually we should suspend because Sajid Javid has had the cheek to overrule them.
Well, the interesting thing is, I mean, there have been other instances as well. For example, a discourse between Boris Johnson and Liam Fox, Boris Johnson sort of like overruled sort of any doubts in that situation. That was reported in The Guardian this week. But also the government's own committee that that controls arms exports in September last year, actually they couldn't agree on whether or not they should stop arms sales. In fact, both sides on the argument actually said that there were crimes against international war crimes going on, but one side said we should stop selling arms straight away, and the other side said no, we should continue in spite of that because something worse might happen if we stopped selling the arms. And so so even in September last year, the committee that controlled arms couldn't agree, and one part of it, the biggest part of it, actually said that we should stop selling arms to Saudi Arabia. Now, that's the committee that advises the government, so it's not recent.
I would advise people, definitely, if you want to follow this stuff, to go to Middle East Eye, because I've just noticed that he's jumped ship at The Guardian and he's now working for Middle East Eye. This is Richard Norton Taylor. He's not the first person to have done that. Martin, maybe you could just give us why? What on earth is in the minds of the Saudis, the Brits, the Americans, the people who are running these satellite imaging to tell them where to bomb? Why are they doing this?
Well, it's about international geopolitical skullduggery, really, isn't it? I mean, Saudi Arabia effectively invaded both Bahrain and Yemen. Now, that, in fact, is a complete defiance of international law. It's like the Russian invasion of Czechoslovakia or Hungary. But, of course, far from condemning
But the question
them,
is, who's going to do anything about it?
Well, I'll tell you who's doing something about it is that the faction of the Yemeni army, which has gone with the Houthi rebels, they're actually pretty militarily competent. There was that they fired a ground-to-air missile at the military base in Riyadh from inside Yemen. And, of course, probably that's where the British personnel are. And, of course, if those British personnel were killed by those missiles, then they've got it coming.
What about this attack on a Saudi vessel recently?
Well, that was that. Of course, Trump's spokesperson tried to spin that as an Iranian attack on an American vessel. But what it was, although we're not quite sure, was an attack on a Saudi vessel by Houthi rebels using ship-to-ship missiles.
Yeah, and that's not the first time. There's been lots of ships that are damaged by...
it took place. I mean, yeah. There's even doubt whether that took place.
But that...
it then allowed the Americans to bomb the air defence on that...
Yeah, it did. Earlier they bombed an American ship, but also there have been several Saudi ships that have been attacked, and one UAE vessel as well that's been attacked from the ground.
The Houthi side, as it were, are outgunned, but they're actually, as you can imagine, I mean, Yemen is a fairly militarised society.
Oh, very much so, especially
now. And they're pretty good.
Yeah.
I mean, they're actually there's parts of Saudi Arabia which used to be part of Yemen,
yeah.
And they're actually attacking into Saudi Arabia. Now, in actual fact...
When Martin says it's a militarised society, what does he mean by that, Julius?
Well, I think that this is not in the cities, but outside the cities, the tribal areas have carried a phenomenal amount of guns. I think that before the war, there were more guns per head in Yemen than in any other country in the world. And people actually carried guns everywhere. I mean, if you walked into rural areas, you saw lots of young men carrying rifles. It was a normal thing to do. You didn't even sort of like think about it. In fact, you know,
sounds like the Wild West. I mean, were people just shooting each other or what?
Actually, it's a strange thing because there were tribal wars from time to time. Yes, I can't deny that there were. But in fact, the number of people that were killed by these guns was actually really small. It was far, the homicide rate was apparently far smaller than in America per head, even though the gun ratio was actually higher in Yemen than in America. So a lot of it was just sort of like tribal things and people shot at, you know, that they would have gun practice across valleys, and you would see them shooting a tin can on the other side of the valley. But in the very north west of Yemen, the Saada area, there've been where the Houthis' homeland, in other words, there've been wars there since 2004 to 2010, which involved the ex-president Saleh and the Houthi militias, and also Saudi Arabia joined in as well, and so there are areas where there have been pockets of fighting. For example, in some areas of that were between the old north and south of Yemen, there's been fighting between Al Qaeda and the Houthi militias, between Al Qaeda and the Yemen army. So there have been pockets of fighting from time to time in Yemen, and so that there have been tribal, ongoing tribal wars. But they tended to happen and then be sort of like solved, and people would sort of like accept it. The difficulty now, and you know, I do wonder at this because you know, I do think about the situation in between Iraq and Iran, where Iraq was encouraged to take on Iran, and then when it was weakened, we took over its oil. And I do wonder a bit with Saudi Arabia whether they're being a bit naive in fighting wars for the West, because this is costing Saudi Arabia a lot. I know some Saudi Arabian people here in Bristol, and they're saying that, you know, at home there's taxes have had to go up, there's not so much subsidies on things, so they're hurting financially because of the war on Yemen, and also of course because the low petrol price. And Saudi Arabia is, I mean, it's having to sell 10% of Saudi Aramco oil. And this is sort of like at the start of the war. There is no doubt that Saudi Arabia would like to end this war. And in fact, so would the Houthis. The difficulty is that both sides want to end the war, saying that they've won it. And so, and of course, they're the people who are fighting. And the people who aren't fighting just don't care. I mean, one man in Yemen said to me, I don't even care if Israel takes over and rules Yemen as long as we can have peace and food. So therefore, it's the irony is that all of the fighting people want to stop, but they all can't give up fighting unless they can prove that they've got some sort of victory. And the people in the West who could be honest brokers to try and create a win-win peace deal aren't interested in doing it.
Now, one of the things which has been used for many years now are drones in Yemen. Apparently, it's a bit like the doodle bugs in World War II, where people could hear these things droning, and now it's very similar in Yemen, because you can hear these things before they come and blow your street up or your house to pieces or your neighbour. The US drone killing machine is now an autopilot, apparently. For years, we've been pointing out that Obama's lasting legacy would be his ill-advised decision back in 2009 to normalise these assassinations around the world. And the question, of course, is what's happening under Trump? Well, Martin, it looks as if much of this stuff is now without of the purview of the president himself. So the military are just getting on and killing people with drones willy-nilly.
Absolutely.
Well, I mean, we're still seeing Trump's policy develop, but I don't think there's much hope that he's going to be a peacemaker, as some people seem to think. I think that what's going to happen in the end of this is that the Saudi state's going to collapse. That's what's going to happen. And, of course, there's going to be general disorder in the Middle East if we carry on down this road. And, of course, what should be, you know, in Syria, the Britain and the US have supported armed uprisings against much more stable regimes with a much better human rights record than Saudi Arabia. And if we were to be logical to our own position that armed struggle is legitimate against Gaddafi and Assad, then why isn't it legitimate against the Saudi government? And we should be sending our special forces to execute these people and blow them up and bomb them so that we can bring democracy, surely. And of course, Trump's ban on countries, people coming from certain countries. And of course, the big thing that isn't in the ban is Saudi Arabia, where supposedly all 19 hijackers on 9/11...
To the 19,
yeah,
15.
...were supposedly Saudi nationals. And of course, there's lots of debate about what actually happened.
Some of the latest on this, just today in The Guardian, Boris Johnson has urged the UK to continue Saudi arms sales after the funeral bombing. Letters between Foreign Secretary and Liam Fox reveal UK weapons exports were under review following the bombing of a funeral in Yemen. Boris Johnson pressed Liam Fox to continue exports of weapons to Saudi Arabia after this bombing in Yemen last October that killed over 140 people and was condemned by UN monitors and pretty much everyone else on the planet that saw what was going on there. Someone who'd been killed previously, they went to his funeral and 140 mourners were then massacred. And Boris Johnson seems to think this is wonderful, we can do it all again. Correspondence between the ministers shows a month after the strike, Johnson wrote, "I'm aware you have deferred a decision on 4 export license applications to support the Royal Saudi Air Force with equipment which could be used in the conflict in Yemen." The letters dated 8th of November. Johnson advised the Trade Secretary it was right to proceed with the arms sales. And although he calls it a complex situation, he's saying, yes, this is fine, just ticking it off, basically.
And the other thing is that Vince Cable actually said that he was put under pressure to sign off arms sales to Saudi Arabia when he was business secretary. He's reported that too. So, and he said he was actually told lies that eventually made him sign them off. And he later found out the things he'd been told weren't true.
Fascinating. Anyway, Judith, I'll just leave the last word to you. What you think, if you think there is a solution to this, and if so, what do you think it is?
Well, the first thing that has to be done is to stop the Saudi bombing. But it'd be interesting if we have the court case today, this week, and they say that the arms sales are illegal. Will it stop arms sales? I don't know whether it will or not. And if it stops them from UK, will it stop them from other countries? But I think until we can actually stop the Saudi bombing, I think that there are still ongoing groups wanting to fight in Yemen. But once we've got the external factors removed, I think that Yemenis themselves would have much more chance of finding peace, because they're more desperate. They're in the desperate situation.
Getting bigger by being better. The number one choice for Bristol. This is BCFM 93.2.
Martin, I think we'll go on to talk about some of the related subjects, and we'll start with the visit of Benjamin Netanyahu to Downing Street this week. Saw quite an amusing video of him walking backwards and forwards outside Downing Street as if he was either a bit early or nobody had noticed that he was there. So anyway, so that came up at Prime Minister's Questions with Eric Pickles, the former Community Secretary.
Sir Eric Pickles.
Friends meeting with Mr. Netanyahu this week. Did you press that the only way to get a lasting peace settlement is for young Palestinians and young Israelis to look forward to a job, a sharing prosperity and a life without fear? Does she agree that the only way to achieve this is face-to-face negotiations? And will she join the Israeli Prime Minister in pressing the Prime Minister of the Palestinian authorities for face-to-face negotiations?
My right honourable friend does make a very important point about this. We continue as a Conservative government in the UK to believe that the two-state solution is the right one. That means a viable Palestinian state, but also a safe and secure Israel. And, of course, it is for the parties to negotiate. Obviously, there are others on the international arena who are doing their work to facilitate an agreement in the Middle East. But ultimately, it is for the two parties to agree a way forward.
More of the same old flannel, isn't it, really? Nothing gets done for the Palestinians. Everybody pretends something's going to be done, but nothing ever is. And the British government's position, remains one of basically encouraging the Israelis to do whatever they want, not least because the Israelis got a huge spying operation operating within our politics, trying to control our political parties.
Netanyahu came to London hoping to persuade Theresa May to join him in overturning the Iran nuclear deal, didn't he? And he failed there.
Yeah, but we'll have to wait to see what Trump does, and if Theresa May is going to go with Trump, then she'll have to go along with what he wants, won't she?
Also, this week in the Times of Israel, a fascinating article about Lord Rothschild discussing his cousin's crucial role in the miracle Balfour Declaration. Some would call it one of the biggest disasters in the whole of history. The current and fourth Lord Rothschild, that's Jacob Rothschild, has described the Balfour Declaration that helped pave the way for the creation of Israel as a miracle and revealed new details about his cousin Dorothea's crucial role, speaking ahead of the 67-word letters centenary. They are his first ever public comments on the show of support from then Foreign Secretary Lord Balfour in the interview with former Israeli Ambassador Daniel Taub as part of the Balfour 100 project. Jacob Rothschild is 80, head of the family's banking dynasty, said that the declaration of support for a Jewish homeland in Palestine went through five drafts before finally being penned on the 2nd of November 1917, adding it was the greatest event in Jewish life for thousands of years, a miracle. It took 3,000 years to get to this.
Well, I mean, the Balfour Declaration, obviously, by the British, has created the political problem that we now see in Israel-Palestine. And, we can't unpick all these things, but we've got to be honest about what the history really is. And of course, Israel was perceived by the British as a little Ulster, which would protect the Suez Canal from potential geopolitical rivals.
Okay, he also revealed for the first time the role of his cousin, Dorothy de Rothschild, who acted as a critical go-between while still in her teens, describing her as devoted to Israel. Rothschild said what she did was crucially important to connect Weizmann to the British establishment, and extraordinarily she told Weizmann how to integrate, how to insert himself into the British establishment life, which she learned very quickly. Her letters, which are stored at Waddesdon, the family home in Hertfordshire, I think, detail her latest dealings with a range of Zionist leaders, her advice on the organisation of the Zionist conferences, and Rothschild said she had a profound effect on him, introducing him to Israel and the family's philanthropic foundations in 1962. So that is a bit of a revelation that the Balfour Declaration was really the Rothschild Declaration.
Well, the Rothschilds family dynasty has had an awful lot of power in a lot of places for a very long time, and they still do. Some stuff I've read recently suggests that the wealth of the Rothschilds family is greater than that of many others that we're more aware of. But these historical realities continue to make the present world an extremely dangerous place for us all to live in.
Okay, also, staying with Israel, verified Alex Jones, at least it says verified, Alex Jones, the 9/11 truth shock jock from Austin, Texas, is on the payroll of a very, very important nation and a very, very important leader. This is on the Willie Lohman blog, willielohman.wordpress.com. So he says, he's talking about Jones and Jerome Corsi are seen pumping up the chosen ones on his website and delivering the breaking news that Bibi will nominate Trump for a peace prize for moving the US embassy in Tel Aviv to East Jerusalem. And is this actually going to happen? And also, what is the connection he's making here between Alex Jones and the Israeli Secret Services?
Well, people might not know who Alex Jones is, but I mean, he is quite famous, and he's a friend of Donald Trump's, a supporter of Donald Trump's. So Trump phoned him to congratulate him, you know, to thank him for his support during his election campaign. But he's known in this country as a 9/11 truth campaigner. Very paradoxical, really. Trump himself said, of course, that the buildings on 9/11 must have been bombed, because he's a guy who builds such buildings, and it certainly wasn't planes that brought them down. So what you've got, the suggestion is that Alex Jones does work with the Israelis, which is why, although he's a 9/11 truther, he's very keen not to point the finger at the Israelis for involvement in the attacks, although of course there's a lot of evidence that suggests that they were, and of course in the US military as well.
Okay, so also there's a new group popping up in Bristol because Bristol Stop the War, they're saying, are being too supportive of Trump and too sort of veering, sorry, anti-Trump and also anti-Russia. And they believe that Russia has been actually a force for good and force for peace. So why the Stop the War in the Middle East is anti-Trump? Anyway, let's be nice to get to the bottom of that over future weeks and see if these are really true or allegations. Stop the War, of course, is in many places dominated by the Socialist Workers Party.
It's not entirely true, Tony.
Sorry?
It's not entirely true.
Go on, then.
The Stop the War Coalition has been one of the most effective political movements in this country. And, of course, the SWP are active within it, but so many Labour Party members like myself and so...
Maybe you can tell us about this. Why would they be so anti-Russian?
The problem is, with not just with the SWP, but with some of the left in this country, is that they have a plague on both your houses policy. They see both America and Russia as imperialist powers, and that therefore, you know, the honest thing is to be against both of them.
Anyway,
and I think that's slightly missing.
Anyway,
the point.
The daughter of the former Egyptian ambassador, Vanessa Bealey, British ambassador to Egypt, is coming to Bristol this time next week, and I spoke to Mehnaz Shahabi, who's one of the organisers of that meeting.
Israel is at the centre of it because Israel wants to be the superpower in the region with complete supremacy, and it is not even the question of the nature of the government in Iran. Basically, Israel wants to be the supreme power in the region, and its interests are aligned with the interests of the United States, strategic
interests.
Well,
I can remember back in 1973, the October War in 73, where I think it was the Lebanese and the Syrians invaded Israel, attacked Israel anyway, at the Golan Heights and places like that. Immediately the Americans came to their aid with literally thousands of tons of military aid that came in by plane immediately. Obviously, if something was to break out, a war between Iran and Israel, the Americans would do the same. They'd be immediately coming in on the Israeli side.
Yes.
I mean, it's almost unthinkable to have such a war because it would so quickly escalate.
It would definitely escalate, and it would be a ferocious war that actually make what's happened in Iraq and what's happening in Syria into kids' play. It will be a ferocious war.
Could either side win that war? Who's the stronger country?
Israel will have the backing of NATO countries and the United States, but I think it's much more complex than that. I think that still, I hope that there will be enough sanity for people to realize that such a war is not winnable. Also, I don't think that Russia and China will be able to sit back and allow Iran to be attacked, because their own national security interests will be endangered.
I mean, I suppose you'd have to be quite a brave military person in Iran to actually, even if you were attacked by Israel, to strike back, because knowing where it would lead.
Well, what Iran has always maintained is that we will not attack any country. We will not attack our enemies. But if we are attacked, we will ferociously retaliate. And I think there'll be no choice but to do that. And in relation to this missile program, they've said that it is really only for defensive purposes. And with the history of Iran-Iraq war, when Iraq was aided by almost all countries, apart from just a very small
number
of countries.
Well, it was the United States that put them up to it, wasn't it?
That's right. It was sort of war against Iran. And Iran was being bombed, and it did not have any missiles to fight back. And Iran's foreign minister Zarif actually has said in a very moving video that we will not allow that to happen again. We have to look after, defend ourselves, look
anyway,
after our interests.
Vanessa Bealey is the daughter of former British ambassador to
That's
Egypt.
Right, yes.
I know she's coming to Bristol very soon.
She is coming to Bristol. Bristol Open Inquiry into the UK bombing of Syria invited Vanessa on 4th of November. And we had a fantastic meeting in the ARC, and she exposed the fake news on Syria. Now, Vanessa went back to Aleppo again in December and witnessed the final stages of liberation of Aleppo, went to East Aleppo. She's one of the very, very few Western journalists, the journalists, in fact, who have been on the ground in Aleppo and in East Aleppo.
Now, I've spoken to Vanessa, and I know that she does contact London media and says, look, I'm on the ground. They don't want to know.
No, they don't want to know. They don't want to know. I mean, Vanessa has been one of the people, vociferous person who's done research and exposed the nature of the white helmets. We have got a meeting with her on Friday, 17th of February, between 7 to 9 p.m. in the ARC, Broad Street, Bristol, and also Andrew Ashdown, who was in our previous meeting, Reverend Andrew Ashdown, who'd been on the ground in Syria, was in Syria again in December when Vanessa was there. And he's told me this afternoon that he'll be in the meeting as well and will be able to testify.
So anyone that's scratching their heads watching the BBC saying, I'm not sure if I believe what I'm being told here, get yourself down to the ARC on Broad Street at the bottom.
Absolutely.
On the left-hand side. What's the date and the time again?
It is Friday, 17th of February, between 7 to 9, ARC 27 Broad Street.
So that's this time next Friday that will all be starting. Also, Martin, it's number two in prefabs looking at cyber warfare, real privacy. I would suggest people have a good look at GNU PG or PGP. And we've got a permanent page up now with prefabs up on the show page at thisweek.org.uk. You need a passphrase for that. It also generates a key pair which you can share all your emails and then be encrypted. You can also use it to wipe disks properly. So we'll go through the rest of those in future weeks. But final story, Martin, is these four arrests of four senior cyber security officials in Russia.
Well, they're being accused of working for the West. I don't know whether it's true. Let's give them a fair trial and find out if they are traitors.
I mean, we're talking about public sector and private sector. One of the senior Kaspersky people. And what about the geopolitics of all this? Why now?
Well, because everybody's talking up cyber war, aren't they? The supposed hacking of elections. So it's all very much to the grist of the mill, isn't it?
OK, time to sign off for the Murdoch News at 7. Coming up, Arabian Nights with Mohammed Makawi. Thanks to our first hour guest, Metro Mayor candidate for the Conservatives, Tim Bowles. Our sister show, Dialects, on BCFM at noon every Tuesday. We can hear more from Mayor Naz and also from James Files, the assassin of John F. Kennedy. Our show page is thisweek.org.uk. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling. Wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for the Politics Show at the same time next week. God bless, and don't let the banksters get you down.
At 7, the Defence Secretary is shutting down a controversial long-running investigation into allegations of abuse by UK troops in Iraq. One of the main lawyers acting for claimants was recently struck off for dishonest conduct. MPs branded the probe an unmitigated failure. Sir Michael Fallon says virtually all the cases are being dismissed.
Most of these allegations now fall away as a result of the evidence that we put before the Solicitor's Disciplinary Tribunal. There will be a handful of remaining allegations which will now be...